Chapter 6 The Assassination of Robert Kennedy. The Incident. Robert F. Kennedy was assassinated in the pantry of the Ambassador Hotel in Los Angeles on June 5, 1968, after winning the California primary and seeming to clinch the Democratic nomination for president. The official word. Sirhan Bishara Sirhan, a young Palestinian opposed to Kennedy's policy toward Israel, fired a pistol 8 times from a few feet in front of him, was taken into custody immediately, and pled guilty to the murder. My take. Sirhan didn't have enough rounds in his gun to make all the bullet holes found by police, so there was a second gunman firing from behind. He was hypnotically programmed, using methods developed by the CIA, to take part in the murder. A revolution is coming, a revolution which will be peaceful if we are wise enough, compassionate if we care enough, successful if we are fortunate enough, but a revolution which is coming whether we will it or not. We can affect its character. We cannot alter its inevitability. From a speech by Robert Kennedy in the U.S. Senate, May 9, 1966. At the time Robert Kennedy was gunned down in the pantry of the Ambassador Hotel in L.A. on June 5, 1968, I viewed it more as a copycat political murder, this young Palestinian Sirhan Sirhan, who didn't like Kennedy's policies toward Israel. Much like 5 years earlier, Oswald had been a disgruntled communist. It was now a trend, a cycle, where if a Kennedy decided to run for president, some idiot would put an end to it. At that point, I still didn't believe the government would lie to me. This was before my doubting of the Warren Commission, which didn't start until I got out of the military and heard Mark Lane speak. Later, the death of Robert Kennedy became the turning point, where I felt either their father, Joe, had done something that was never going to be forgiven, or there certainly were forces out there ensuring another Kennedy would never occupy the White House. To say that my trust of the establishment had deteriorated would be an understatement. Robert Kennedy was only 42 when he was assassinated, and having just won the California primary, was on his way to the Democratic nomination and likely the presidency. He would have begun withdrawing our troops from Vietnam and saved thousands of American lives. He had already been talking with his aides about reopening the investigation into who killed his brother. I think it's safe to say that if he'd lived, we'd have a different kind of country than what we've become. Robert would have led a compassionate revolution, because he was a man not only of courage, but of compassion. That night in the Ambassador Hotel, it seemed a pretty open and shut case that Sirhan was another lone nut. After all, he was wrestled to the ground after firing his .22 caliber revolver from a few feet in front of Kennedy. The police soon found a diary, in which Sirhan wrote over and over that RFK must die. We soon learned he'd been stalking the senator, which again raises the question in my mind as to how come nobody in authority picked up on Sirhan as a potential threat. The curious thing, even at his trial, was that Sirhan had no memory of committing the killing. He still doesn't. Let's start by looking at the physical evidence. First of all, Sirhan's revolver held only 8 rounds, and he never had time to reload. But a reporter's recording has what audio expert Philip Van Praagh has determined are 13 shots in a little more than 5 seconds. 2 of those are what forensic experts call double shots, meaning they happen so close together that there's no way they came from the same gun. In pictures taken in the pantry later that night, you can see some policemen looking up at what they later said was a bullet hole in a ceiling panel. The trouble is, that's behind where Sirhan was shooting from. The L.A. County coroner, Thomas Noguchi, said almost right away that the fatal shot had come from less than an inch away from Kennedy's head, behind the right ear. That, of course, also rules out Sirhan. You'd think some of this might have come up at Sirhan's trial, but his defense attorneys decided not to challenge any evidence because their claim was that Sirhan had diminished capacity, a nice way of saying he was crazy, and they were looking to get him a life sentence instead of the death penalty. Again, once he pled guilty, there was no real trial with witnesses who might contradict the official story. After a judge approved a citizen's petition to reinvestigate the firearms evidence, in 1977 the L.A. District Attorney's Office wrote that the apparent lack of reports, both written and photographic, either made and destroyed or never in existence, raised serious doubts as to the substance and reliability of the ballistics evidence presented in the original Sirhan trial. So if not Sirhan, then who killed RFK? Well, several witnesses saw a security guard who was standing behind Kennedy draw his gun, and one witness even said that he fired it. This was a fellow named Thane Eugene Caesar. He was a plumber by trade who'd been hired part-time by Ace Security less than a week before the assassination, his assignment being to guard the pantry that night. One of Caesar's first statements to the police was that he'd been holding Kennedy's arm when they shot him. Not he, but they. He said when he saw Sirhan's gun, he reached for his own. But the LAPD never asked to see his gun or even to ask him what kind it was. Years later, he passed a polygraph overseen by author Dan Moldea, who called Caesar an innocent bystander caught in the crossfire of history. Well, maybe he was. Or maybe not. Acoustics expert Van Praagh did tests on an H&R 922 pistol of the type that Caesar had on him, and concluded that an H&R 922 had been fired at the same time as Sirhan's. Then, too, besides Sirhan and Caesar, another man with a gun was mentioned by several more witnesses. Conceivably, that person could have gotten in between Kennedy and the security guard to fire the fatal shot as RFK was falling back from Sirhan. The strongest evidence that Sirhan had accomplices are no less 14 witnesses who all talked about a girl in a polka-dot dress. A 20-year-old Youth for Kennedy volunteer immediately reported seeing such a girl, both to the press and the police. Earlier in the night, Sandra Serrano said she'd observed a young woman dressed in a white dress with black or dark blue polka dots walking up a back stairway of the hotel. She was with two men, one well-dressed in a white shirt and gold sweater, and the other rather disheveled and short, with black bushy hair, who was likely Sirhan. Then, after the assassination, Serrano saw the same girl running down a fire escape out of the hotel and shouting, "We shot him! We shot him! We shot Kennedy!" Later, an LAPD interrogator put heavy pressure on Serrano to recant her story, which she did at the time. But when Serrano was interviewed again, 40 years later, she stuck to what she'd originally said. And she wasn't the only one who reported seeing something like this. Police Sergeant Paul Shiraga, who was in the hotel's back parking lot 6 minutes after the shooting, also heard a young couple run past yelling about having killed Kennedy. He put out an APB, but Shiraga said when he went to look for the three copies he made of his report 2 weeks later, they had vanished. Sirhan himself said, "I met the girl and had coffee with her. She wanted heavy on the cream and sugar. After that, I don't remember a thing until they pounced on me in that pantry." Could it be that the girl said some key word or phrase that triggered his amnesia? According to the LAPD logs, The cops were looking for two suspects besides Sirhan within minutes of the assassination. Then they stopped searching within the hour because they only have one man and don't want them to get anything started on a big conspiracy. This could be somebody that was getting out of the way so they wouldn't get shot. Huh? That makes no sense at all for an honest investigator to reason. The fact is, the LAPD had a long history of special relationship with the CIA, from helping out with clandestine activities to training certain officers for double duty. When they formed Special Unit Senator, SUS, to look into the assassination, the two main cops through which all information flowed both had ties to the CIA. In retrospect, it seems odd that policemen who doubled as CIA agents occupied key positions in SUS, where they were able to seal off avenues that led in the direction of conspiracy. They also badgered any witness who didn't support the Sirhan did it alone scenario. Manuel Pena, a multilingual fellow who'd done special ops for CIA, saw all the SUS reports and was the man responsible for approving all interviews. His partner, Sergeant Enrique Hank Hernandez, handled all the polygraph work, which he'd also done in Vietnam, South America, and Europe. Both Pena and Hernandez had been undercover CIA with the Agency for International Development, AID. Later, Hernandez started his own security firm and got rich, handling big government contracts. As soon as Sirhan's trial ended, the LAPD got busy destroying evidence, including the ceiling panels and door frames from the pantry that they'd taken pictures of showing extra bullet holes. Their rationale, when asked later, was these were too large to fit into a card file. Once again, we've got the authorities destroying evidence at a crime scene, just like with the King case. They also burned some 2,400 photographs, supposedly all duplicates, but we know some important ones are still missing, like the pictures taken by a 15-year-old kid named Scott Enyart. He was standing on a table so he could get a good view of Kennedy as he came in and took three rolls of Kodak film that the cops confiscated afterwards and said he could get back if he came around in 20 years. Enyart had to fight in court to eventually be returned only 18 prints, no negatives, which were then promptly stolen out of the back seat of a car. Also gone missing were X-rays and test results on ceiling tiles and door frames, spectrographic test results for bullets, the left sleeve of Senator Kennedy's coat and shirt, the test gun used as a substitute for Sirhan's gun during ballistics tests, and results from the 1968 test firing of Sirhan's gun. Tapes of key interviews that raised the question of conspiracy disappeared, too. When the LAPD declassified more files in 2008, 40 years too late, a fuller picture of Sirhan started to appear. He was raised a Christian, wanted to be a jockey, and spent a good bit of time betting on horses at the Santa Anita racetrack. He wanted to make a bundle of money, and seems to have had some gambling debts. His personality appeared to change after he fell off a horse in September 1966. That's when he began developing a curiosity about mysticism, such as the Rosicrucians, and got into learning self-hypnosis. Toward the end of 1967, Sirhan pretty much dropped out of sight for 3 months. His mother was worried because she didn't know where he'd gone. When he finally did come home, his interest in hypnosis escalated. At the same time, somebody put Sirhan under clandestine surveillance for reasons that were never explained. Some 16-millimeter footage taken of Sirhan late in 1967, by whom or for what purpose we don't know, later showed up in a drawer of a private detective's office. In mid-February 1968, Sirhan bought a .22-caliber Ivor Johnson, the pistol he would use the night of the assassination, for $25 on the street. A gun shop owner remembered him coming in with several other people asking for armor-piercing ammunition, for another weapon he doesn't seem to have owned. So it sure looks like somebody was prompting Sirhan. He was also seen stalking Kennedy on two other occasions, both times with a young female companion, at a luncheon May 20th and a downtown L.A. rally 4 days after that. And he was seen doing target practice at Tin Cans with a young brunette and a tall guy who had sandy-colored hair. What does it all add up to? A few weeks before the assassination, the Providence Evening Bulletin ran a story headlined, "To Sleep, Perchance to Kill?" It told of a visiting professor of psychology at Rhode Island College, who had been a leading advisor to the military since the 1930s on the possible applications of hypnosis. Dr. George H. Estabrooks was quoted that, "Hypnotism is widely used by intelligence agencies of the United States and other countries." He went on to say that the key to creating an effective spy, or assassin, revolved around splitting someone's personality. "It is like child's play now to develop a multiple personality through hypnosis." The professor added that Lee Harvey Oswald and Jack Ruby could very well have been performing through hypnosis. "They would have been perfect cases, but I doubt you will find anyone admitting this possibility, especially in the Warren Report." Estabrooks concluded by referring to the novel and film The Manchurian Candidate as putting forth an entirely possible scenario. The Manchurian Candidate had been a best-selling book in 1958, later made into a movie by John Frankenheimer, who ironically was a good friend of Robert Kennedy's and had him as a house guest right before the assassination. It's about a soldier who gets brainwashed by the communist Chinese during the Korean War, then later is used in the domestic assassination plot against an American presidential contender. This was regarded as pretty wild fiction at the time. Nobody knew until the late 1970s that both the military and the CIA had been experimenting for years with drugs, hypnosis, and other means to figure out how to alter human behavior. Back in 1954, a CIA study had raised the question, "Can an individual of deleted nationality, descent, be made to perform an act of attempted assassination involuntarily against a prominent, deleted politician, or, if necessary, against an American official?" After being drugged, the subject would perform the deed at some later date, after which it was assumed the subject would be taken into custody by the deleted government and thereby disposed of. In June of 1960, the CIA, under the MK-Ultra program, had launched an expanded program of operational experiments in hypnosis in cooperation with the agency's counterintelligence, CI, staff. The program had three goals. One, to induce hypnosis very rapidly in unwitting subjects. Two, to create durable amnesia. And three, to implant durable and operationally useful post-hypnotic suggestions. So what do we have in the case of Sirhan? A year before the government's mind control efforts became public, a nationally recognized expert in hypnosis, Dr. Herbert Spiegel, had this to say, "I've gone over the data very carefully on Sirhan, and my hypothesis is that someone programmed him to be there and fire that gun. I know from his lawyer that he appeared at another political rally that night in the Ambassador Hotel for some right-wing school superintendent. Here's what Sirhan reports. I'm in this rally, and I ask myself, What am I doing here? So I leave. Then I go back to my car, and the next thing I know, there's a gun on the seat. And I don't know where that gun came from. Then all of a sudden, I'm in the kitchen. And he has no recall of how he went from that car into the hotel kitchen. If he was drunk or under drugs, which is possible, it would not be as easily recoverable. But if he were in a trance state and programmed, it is recoverable. Meaning, an expert like Spiegel could still unlock Sir Han's mind today if he were allowed into the California State Prison at Corcoran. Sir Han showed a number of signs of being in some weird zone that night at the Ambassador. A Western Union operator had seen him standing transfixed in front of a teletype machine. Other witnesses observed his intense concentration in the pantry and his almost superhuman strength when being wrestled down, despite a very tranquil look on his face. Policeman Art Pacentia noticed that the pupils of Sir Han's eyes were dilated, which is another indication of a hypnotic state. Just as Oswald was when questioned about the assassination of JFK, Sir Han was oddly detached during that first long night of interrogation. It could be, of course, that Sir Han was in a state of shock after the assassination, but Dr. Bernard Diamond was hired by Sir Han's defense team to check out his mental state, and Diamond put him under hypnosis. Sir Han turned out to be such an easy subject, going under so fast and so deep, that Diamond had trouble keeping him awake. I've learned that a rapid induction like this is a sure sign of someone having been hypnotized before. Diamond could actually get Sir Han to climb the bars of his cell like a monkey, or sing a tune in Arabic. When he once asked Sir Han who killed Senator Kennedy, the response came back, "I don't know, I don't know, I don't know." Yet, strangely, on the opening day of the trial, Sir Han got up and started shouting how he wanted to be executed because he'd killed the senator, willfully, premeditatedly, with 20 years of malice aforethought. Which was the real Sir Han? On the witness stand, Dr. Diamond testified that he was surprised how easy it was to hypnotize Sir Han, but believed Sir Han had basically programmed himself through studying texts on self-hypnosis. The automatic writing found in Sir Han's notebooks, he said, is something that can be done only when one is pretty well trained. Another expert called in was Dr. Edward Simpson Callas, the chief psychologist at San Quentin, when Sir Han was being held there. Simpson Callas thought Sir Han was an ideal Manchurian candidate. He was easily influenced, had no real roots, and was looking for a cause. Once, Sir Han told him, "Sometimes I go in a very deep trance, so I can't even speak. I had to be in a trance when I shot Kennedy, as I don't remember having shot him." But after Sir Han asked Simpson Callas to hypnotize him and see what he could find out, the San Quentin warden terminated their visits. Simpson Callas ended up quitting his job at the prison. Even Roger Lajeunesse, the FBI's liaison to the L.A. County prosecutor, told journalist Robert Blair Kaiser, "The case is still open. I'm not rejecting the Manchurian candidate aspect of it." J. Edgar Hoover told the Washington Post that the interviewer had manufactured the quote, but Kaiser had it on tape. Dr. Spiegel thinks there were probably one senior programmer and many accessories. A couple of names of hypnosis experts have surfaced over the years as being possible Svengalis behind Sir Han. Both did work for either the CIA or FBI, and claim to have been technical advisors on the Manchurian Candidate movie. Both are now dead. One was Dr. William J. Bryan, who phoned the KABC radio station not long after the assassination and said that the suspect had probably been acting under post-hypnotic suggestion. Brian, the founder and executive director of the American Institute of Hypnosis, was known for hypnotizing the Boston Strangler, Albert DeSalvo, after his arrest to see what the mass murderer might reveal. Strangely again, DeSalvo's name appears in Sir Han's notebook, even though Sir Han didn't have the foggiest idea who he was. In 1977, Brian is said to have told a researcher who asked him about Sir Han and programming, "I'm not going to comment on that case because I didn't hypnotize him." After Brian was found dead in his Vegas hotel room in 1977, supposedly of natural causes, some call girls came forward saying he'd once bragged of having hypnotized Sir Han. In the same league as Brian was Dr. William Kroger, a world authority on hypnosis, who consulted for the FBI and the LAPD, and who died in 1996 at almost 90. While alive, he was referenced in Philip Melanson's book on the assassination under the pseudonym of Jonathan Reisner. Kroger and Brian each had an interest in the links between mystical orders and hypnosis, as well as the uses of auto-hypnosis. Melanson made it clear that he suspected Reisner as the man who programmed Sir Han. In the 2 years before Kroger died, my co-author on this book conducted a couple of interviews with the man. Although Kroger denied having anything to do with Sir Han, he did admit knowing Jack Ruby and Sam Giancana, as well as George White, the chief field officer for the CIA's MK-Ultra program. One clue to Sir Han's handlers might be the lawyers who took his case for free. One was Grant Cooper, a well-known L.A. criminal attorney. Sir Han selected his name and that of Russell Parsons right away from a list provided by the ACLU, a list Sir Han had asked for. Parsons did legal work for the mob, having been Mickey Cohen's counsel. Cooper, at the time, was defending one of mobster Johnny Roselli's pals in a cheating scandal at the Friars Club. Cooper gave Sir Han the motive that he was angry at RFK for giving jets to Israel. Prior to this, there was not a single reference to Zionism, Israel, Palestine, or any of the terms Sir Han would spout at his trial as propelling him to murder. Years later, Sir Han said that Cooper sold me out. During conversations with his attorney, Sir Han once asked Cooper, "If I got the money, where is it?" In the strange notebooks he kept before the assassination, there were references to a figure as propelling him to murder. Years later, Sir Han said that Cooper sold me out. During conversations with his attorney, Sir Han once asked Cooper, "If I got the money, where is it?" In the strange notebooks he kept before the assassination, there were references to a figure of $100,000. Also, at least a dozen times, the notation, "Please pay to the order of Sir Han," always on the same pages, where he scrawls things like, "RFK must be disposed of." So it looks like somebody was telling Sir Han he'd be getting paid handsomely for the deed. One fellow he knew by an alias of Frank Donnarumas had hired Sir Han to exercise and groom horses at the racetrack. The first place he worked was a syndicate meeting place, and another track where Sir Han worked was frequented by some of the nation's most infamous racketeers. Donnarumas' real name was Henry Ramostella, with a record of narcotics violations in both New York and Florida. It's been long known that Teamster boss Jimmy Hoffa had made threats against RFK. Joseph Marcello, brother of New Orleans mob boss Carlos Marcello, can be heard telling an informant on tape when the subject of the Kennedys came up, "We took care of him, didn't we?" There's also a file on a Roy Donald Murray, who was overheard by cops saying that he'd pledged some Vegas funds for a mob contract on Robert Kennedy. Same as with his brother's assassination. It's hard to conceive that the mob had enough power to pull this off without government help. Of course, it's possible they knew of MK Ultra and of the hypnosis experts and paid one of those guys to program Sirhan, knowing the CIA and FBI would want to keep that from being exposed. But it still smells to me like there was intelligence involvement. CIA agent David Morales, who hated the Kennedys, allegedly once told his attorney, "I was in Los Angeles when we got Bobby." Morales had come up with a similar scenario for assassinating Castro in a pantry. Can we still get to the bottom of what happened? Maybe, if Sirhan's mind can be deprogrammed. That's what his new attorney, William Pepper, wants to do. He was James Earl Ray's last attorney, too, and he's pushing to start new psychological evaluations of Sirhan with an expert in regression therapy. I'd like to be a fly on the wall for that one, because recently I had a personal experience with a guy who claims to be a programmed Manchurian candidate. I was filming an episode about Big Brother for my new TV series when I met with him in the basement of a parking garage, very much like Deep Throat and All the President's Men. He says that his father was in the CIA, and he was taken as a candidate at the age of 6, selected partly because of his nationality. He's an American Indian. He says his parents didn't have a choice. The only reason he knows today was he was in a bad car wreck. He had to get a full-body MRI, where they discovered 4 different implants. The accident also jostled him to the point where he's getting his memory back about what was done to him and what he's done. I asked him, point blank, "You have killed people?" He said, "Yes, I have." He told me he was 14 when he was first sent to do ops. He keeps referring to "we," meaning that there are way more than him. He said, "We're all getting together now because we want our lives back. They're going to go public. That's one of the reasons I did the interview with you, because we think we might want to have you with us," he said. I told him, "I don't know if I've got that much courage." He said, "Well, we just feel that we need someone with credibility to stand there with us and say, 'Listen to what these people have to say. They're not all crazy. Or if they are, they were made to be that way.' Is this man a real Manchurian candidate? Or is he nuts and making it all up? Like my son said, maybe he had something traumatic happen to him as a kid that set this off. Well, maybe, but whatever happened, he believes it. There's no doubt in my mind about that from the stories he told me. Also, he had a handler, a girl who accompanied him. She said, 'I'm one too. I know his case, and I'm also here to control his multiple personalities. We get strength through each other.' Being left with the impression of how strongly he believes this, then clearly I could see him being able to perform an act of violence. How do I feel about the government, or whoever it is, doing something like this to someone? They should be in jail. These are evil people who don't belong out in society, because obviously they have no regard for another human life. Or are these people so callous that looking at the big picture, they view a body or two as simply collateral damage? They're beyond human feelings? If some have to be destroyed to achieve the goal, it's better for the mass of humanity. I don't fit into that mold. These are the types of things you attribute to the Nazis. Sure, they were exceptionally intelligent, but they were an empire based and designed on evil. If Robert Kennedy had survived the first attempt on his life and tried to implement all that he wanted to do, he'd have been killed again. All the people making money off the Vietnam War, would they let the golden goose be stopped? And to reopen his brother's case? I compare this to President Obama's inaugural address. When I heard him give that dynamic speech the day he took office, I turned to my wife and said, If he attempts to do all this, he's going to be killed. Where he wanted to tread, the same as Bobby Kennedy. You're talking about powerful forces involved in evil who don't sweat one more piece of collateral damage. That's a terrible thing to realize. The things I'm learning about, I come home at night and wonder, why do I need to know this? I was better off being ignorant. Meeting with a man who considers himself a Manchurian candidate, what we talked about scares you, whether you believe it or not. It scared me. And I don't scare easily. What should we do now? If the assassination of Robert Kennedy tells us anything, it's that apparently obvious things are not always what they seem. Here we had what appeared to be an open-and-shut case, with Sirhan Sirhan as the perpetrator. It's almost unthinkable, in polite society, to consider that his mind may have been manipulated by unscrupulous people using techniques out of the Dark Ages. But MK Ultra's existence is a proven fact and should not be forgotten.